You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 100 by Rudolf Steiner, consisting of two lecture cycles. The book itself is entitled True Knowledge of the Christ, and we are listening to the first cycle in that is entitled Theosophy and Rosicrucianism, translated by Anna Moyse. This is Lecture 7, given in Kassel on the 22nd of June, 1907. Today we have to talk about the law of karma, as it is called, the law of cause and effect in the spiritual world. To begin with, we must recall the earlier lectures, which showed us how the whole course of life consists in a number of incarnations, so that all of you have been on earth many times, and will also return many times more. Later we shall hear that it is not right to assume that these incarnations are repeated, forward and back, for all eternity. Instead, we shall see that they did once begin, and that there will be a time when they will cease again, when human beings will have different ways of further development. To begin with, we'll therefore consider the period of time when reincarnations of that kind take place. And we have to be clear in our minds that everything we call destiny, when it comes to character and inner qualities, and also to outward destiny and our situation in life, is due to our earlier incarnations, and that the things we do in this life will in turn have an influence on later lives. The great law of cause and effect governs all our incarnations. Let us consider how this law takes effect in the whole world, not only in the spiritual, but also in the physical world. Assume you have two jugs of water. Take an iron ball, which you have made red hot, and drop it into the first jug of water. What will happen? The water hisses and the ball cools down. Next, take the ball out and put it into the second jug. The water will not hiss, and the ball will not cool down much more. The ball thus behaves quite differently in the two cases. It would not have done what it did in the second case if it had not been put into the first jug before. The behavior in the second case is therefore the effect of what happened to it in the first jug. This is what we call karma. It is the ball's karma that it no longer hisses and does not cool down in the second jug. Now, an example from the animal world will show you that later conditions depend on what has happened in the previous life. Take the creatures which have migrated to the caves in Kentucky. In the total absence of sunlight, the eyes did slowly regress. The material which was otherwise used for the eyes migrated to other organs, and the eyes wasted away. The animals gradually grew blind. And it is the destiny of all the descendants to be born blind. If the parents had not migrated to the dark caves, it would not be the destiny of the descendants to be blind. This state of blindness has thus been the consequence of an earlier activity, migration to the dark caves. According to occult science, everything that happens in the world is due to karma. Karma is the general cosmic law. The Bible also speaks of this karma right at the beginning. It says, quote, "In the beginning God created the world," close quote. If a superficial view is taken of this, which is common today, you will not realize that this is in the terms of karmic law. You will realize it immediately, however, if you take the original of this ancient document, where we hear of this activity, or one of the earliest translations into Latin, the Septuagint, for example, the standard translation of the Old Testament used in the whole Roman Catholic Church to this day, especially Genesis. In this kind of introductory lecture course, intended to show you the tremendous depths of the spiritual scientific view of the world, it is, I think, reasonable to take a step outside our actual subject. People today really have no relationship anymore to the living word. Speech and language have, on the one hand, become a conventional means of communication, and on the other, the language of business. This was very different when the word was created in ancient times. Then, human beings still had a living relationship to the word. Indeed, in earliest times, every single letter used to make up a word had profound meaning. People today have no idea as to what went through the mind of a Hebrew sage in those times when he spoke the word bara, which comes in the first sentence in Genesis and was later translated into Latin as creare, to create. What meaning lies deep down in bara? We still have the same stem in our language today in the word bear, to give birth. The root kr in karma also belongs to creare, so that when we say creare in Latin, this means nothing more or less than something arises due to the influence of earlier conditions, meaning that something arises which karmically is due to something that went before. We can only speak of karma in the present-day sense, since Lucifer has come on the scene, that is, from the moment when man was first at fault. Because of this, anything connected with the word karma also always has something of the concept, in quotes, fault to it. Creare, therefore, means to give rise to something because of a karmic debt. The stem bar does not yet have any of this fault or debt connotation. How has this come about? Doubtless, because the ancient Hebrews were still much more closely connected with the spiritual world, and perfectly clear in their mind that at the time when the Elohim were creatively thinking up the world, there could, as yet, be no thought of karma. In the Latin stage of human evolution, human beings had already been completely separated from the spiritual world, as we shall see on another occasion. They were therefore quite unable to think of the Elohim's creative thinking in anything but a karmic context. Both bara and creare never mean that God created the world from nothing. The meaning behind both these words is that God let earlier states flow across into new ones. In the same way, a mother does not bear a child from nothing. To bear or give birth means that the infant emerges and becomes visible in the world, when before it was hidden in the mother's womb. You see how much the meaning of the Bible can be distorted. First of all, theologians said that God had created the world from nothing. This was because they no longer knew about the periods of cosmic evolution that had preceded the earth state. Whole libraries of books have been written about this. But all those theologians were like Don Quixote fighting windmills. It is always necessary to know whom or what you are fighting, and we must always establish the original meaning of those ancient documents. When we see the law of karma, the way it truly must be seen, as the connection between cause and effect, not only in physical life on earth, between birth and death, but also in the life in the spiritual world, after death. This law of karma will cast light on our own life. Insight into it means profound satisfaction, not only for the rational mind, but in the deepest sense also for heart and mind, providing real insight into our relationship to the world. You will see its great significance more and more clearly, realizing that it needs real insight into this law of karma if we are to make life with the world around us harmonious. It will explain not only the riddles of the world that one must first dream up, but also those we truly meet with at every step in life. Surely it is a riddle to see how one individual is guiltlessly born in the most miserable conditions, and how, in the case of another, the greatest potential gifts have to come to nothing because of the social situation into which the individual is born. We often ask ourselves why one individual is born into such poor conditions through no fault of his own, and another, without having done anything to deserve it specially, is born into a well-to-do family who give her or him all love and attention. These are questions to be ignored only by people today who do not care about things. The deeper our insight into the law of karma, the more shall we see that all the harshness disappears which seems to prevail when one takes only a superficial look at it. We'll then see more and more clearly how it has come about that one individual has to live under one kind of conditions and another under different ones. One or another person's life will only seem harsh if we look only at the one life. If we know that this one life is the absolute effect of earlier actions, this harshness goes away completely, and we realize that human beings prepare their lives for themselves. Someone might say, quote, "Yes, but that is a terrible thing if one has to think that people are themselves responsible for the strokes of destiny in their life." Close quote. Here we have to understand that the law of karma is not for sentimental, brooding people. It is a law for action, making us strong, giving us courage and hope. For although we have ourselves created the life we live, with all its difficulties, we also know that it is a law, the main significance of which lies not in the past, but in the future. However much we are at the present time oppressed by the consequences of past deeds, insight into the law of karma will bear fruit in later lives. Depending on what we do, the fruits of these actions will be there in future lives, for no action is taken in vain. Think how much more theosophical it is to see the law of karma as a law for doing. For whatever we do, we cannot escape the fruits of our actions. The worse things are for us in our present life, the better we are at accepting it, the better will things be for us in future lives. The law of karma solves the riddles we meet with at every step in life. How does the previous life relate to the later one? We have to understand that all the inner effects of outside experiences have an effect in the coming life, being pleasure or pain. As you know, all pleasure and pain, joy or unhappiness that live in us are in our astral body. Everything our astral body lives through in this life, especially if events repeat themselves, will in the next life be evident as a quality of the ether body. The joy you awaken again and again in your soul with regard to an object in your life will mean that you will have a deep regard and preference for this object in your next life. Regard and preference are character traits, however, which are present in the ether body. So that anything which the astral body brought about in the previous life will be qualities of the ether body in the next life. Things you experience repeatedly in this life will be your basic character in the next life. A melancholic temperament develops if the individual has had many sad experiences in the previous life that put him again and again in a sad mood. It has given the next ether body the tendency to be melancholic. Conversely, people who are able to look always on the positive side and so generate pleasure and joy, happy high-mindedness in their astral body, will in their next life have a lasting character trait in the ether body that gives them a cheerful temperament. When someone who has to face difficult things in life overcomes them with energy, his ether body will be born with a choleric temperament in the next life. Knowing all this, we can actually prepare ourselves an ether body for the next life. The qualities which the ether body has in one life will in the next life appear in the physical body. So if someone has bad habits and character traits and does nothing to overcome them, this will appear as a disposition of the physical body in the next life, literally a disposition to disease. It may sound strange to you, but the disposition for particular diseases, and especially infectious diseases, does indeed come from bad habits in the previous life. With this insight, it is therefore also up to us to prepare health or sickness for our next life. If we get out of a bad habit, we make ourselves physically sound and resistant to infection in our next life. It is therefore possible to take care of our health in the next life if we endeavor to cultivate only good and noble qualities. Now, to a third thing that is extraordinarily important for seeing the law of karma in the right light. We have to put the right value on our actions, even in this life. So far, we have only spoken of things that occur within the human being. But the things we do in this life, that is, the way we act toward the world around us, will, in the next life, have their effect in this very world around us. I have not really done anything if I just have a bad habit, but if it makes me act, then this action will change the outside world. And everything which had such an effect on the physical world outside will come to us as external destiny in our next life in the outside world. The actions of the physical body in this life will be our destiny in the next life. We learn of this as we find ourselves in one situation or another. Whether a person is happy or unhappy in one situation in life or another will depend on actions performed in the previous life. The Vaimic murder again serves as an apt, instructive example, which shows how an outward action in one life comes back to the individual concerned as destiny in the next life. So these are the karmic situations of individuals in brief outline. We must, however, speak not only of the karma of individuals. That would be absolutely wrong. As wrong as when an individual finger on our hand wanted to see itself as an individual entity. Someone who would rise above the earth for a few miles would get exactly as far as the finger would get if it were to separate from the organism. Concerning ourselves with the science of the spirit, we would literally be forced to realize, from the insight we have thus gained, that we must not deceive ourselves and insist that we are individual entities. It is like this in the physical and very much more so in the spiritual world. We are part of the whole world, and also have our destiny as part of the whole. Karma affects not only individuals, but also the life of whole nations. An example. You all know that leprosy was a disease of medieval times. It did not disappear from Europe until the 16th century. There was a quite particular reason why it appeared in medieval times, and this was a non-physical reason. Materialists are, of course, inclined to ascribe such an infectious disease to bacilli. But it is not just the physical cause which plays a role in such a disease. This is just as if someone were given a thorough thrashing and one was asked to investigate why he had been thrashed. A reasonable person will easily see that the cause of the thrashing was that there are some rough characters in the village. But it would be downright silly in this case to conclude, like a materialist, that when someone comes and tells us that the man's back is black and blue, that this is wholly and entirely because sticks struck his back so and so many times. The sticks are undoubtedly the materialistic cause of the back being black and blue, but it is the rough people who are the deeper cause. Thus leprosy has bacilli for its materialistic cause, but there is also a cause in mind and spirit. Crying provides a perfect analogy to this. The mental cause is sorrow, the material one, the secretion from the tear glands. It is hard to believe that a quite significant academic of the present time has managed to come to the same foolish conclusion as the one just given, for he made the downright mind-blowing statement that human beings do not cry because they feel sorry. They feel sorry because they cry. Back to leprosy now. In this case, if you want to explain the deeper cause of this disease, the one that is not physical, you must look back on a significant historical event, the time when great hordes invaded Europe from the east, causing fear and terror. Those Asian hordes were peoples who had remained at the ancient Atlantean stage and were therefore in decline. They were peoples, therefore, who had a powerful kind of decline or decay element in their astral body. Nothing would have happened if their rush on Europe had not caused shock or terror. As it was, those hordes caused fear and terror and shock. Whole nations experienced these states of fear and shock. The decaying astrality of the Huns then got mixed into the astral bodies, harrowed by fear and terror of the invaded nations. The degenerated astral bodies of Asian tribes offloaded their bad astral matter onto the astral bodies of the Europeans. And this decaying matter was the cause of the physical effects of the disease at a later time. That is, in truth, the deep spiritual cause of leprosy in medieval times. Something which happened in the minds of people did later on appear in the physical body. Only those who know this law of karma and are able to see through it have the right to intervene actively in the course of history. I am now going to tell you about something which contributed to the establishment of the theosophical philosophy of life. It is this. Karma has its effects on individuals and also on nations, and indeed humanity as a whole. Any student of the history of European civilization will know that materialism came up about 400 years ago. It is essentially harmless in science, for there faults will always be spotted and made up for. It is much more harmful in practical life, for there everything is done from the point of view of material interests. Materialism would never have entered into practical life if people had not felt attracted by it, and there would not have been a Büchner, and so on, if people had not already been so much attached to material things. Materialism is, however, most harmful in religious life, that is, in the church. The Church has, for centuries, been steering toward materialism. How? If you go back to the times of early Christianity, you would never have heard of anyone thinking that the 7 days of creation actually were 7 days, which is still widely assumed to be the case today, and that one would imagine the seventh day, in quotes, to be one when someone who has done heavy physical work sits down and takes a rest. Our materialistic age no longer knows anything about the reality of these 7 days of creation. It will be the privilege of theosophy to enlighten people again about this ancient document called Genesis. These materialistic views in religion have eaten their way most deeply into the life of nations. And this materialism will prevail more and more, especially in the field of religion. And it is exactly there where there will be less and less insight, people not understanding that it is the mind and spirit which matters, and not things physical and material. You will, of course, agree that material thinking, feeling, and doing has entered more and more into the whole of people's view of life, and ultimately this will have an effect on the state of health of later generations. An age when people have a sound view of life will create a strong inner focus for human beings, making them self-contained and their descendants strong and robust. An age where people believe only in material things will generate descendants in whose bodies everything goes its own way. There is no focus. And this does give rise to the signs of neurasthenia and nervousness. This would get worse and worse if materialism continued to be the future philosophy of life. The seer can tell you exactly what would happen if materialism were not counterbalanced by a firm spiritual orientation. Mental diseases would then be epidemic. Children would be nervous and suffer from tremors, even at birth. And further consequence of attachment to material things would be a human breed lacking in inner focus, something we do see even today. About 30 years ago, it was this thought and this prospect for humanity. If spiritual means were not used to counter this effect of materialism, which led to the inauguration of the theosophical movement. There may be much that can be said for or against this kind of remedy, but all the objections won't carry much weight. The main thing is that it will help. That is how it is with the healing powers of theosophy. It is intended to prevent something which would inevitably come if humanity continued with materialism as before. You see, therefore, how in thinking about the law of karma in its deeper sense, we cannot consider the human being to be a separate entity, but must see him as being subject to the law of karma also within the community. The law of karma is not for people who want to believe in a destiny that is completely blind. You would be wholly in error if you were to take the law of karma in that sense. Yet one keeps coming across people who have fallen into this error. One person will say, quote, "I know it is not my fault that something or other happens to me. It's just my karma, and I have to live through it." Close quote. Someone else will say, quote, "I see someone who is in trouble, but I must not help him, for it is his own fault. It is his karma, and he must go through it." Close quote. All this is completely nonsensical. To get an idea of karmic law that is easily understood, you might compare it to the business law of debit and credit. A merchant is subject to this law in everything he does. And it is the same when it comes to living with karma. All the good and bad things you have done in your last life are your balance sheet entries. All good qualities on the debit and all bad ones on the credit side of your karma. You should not, however, say, quote, "I must not interfere," close quote. That would be as foolish as if a merchant, having drawn the balance, were to say, quote, now I must not do any more deals, for that would change my balance, close quote. Just as a merchant improves his balance with every good deal, so I too improve my karma with every good thing I do. Just as the merchant is free to make an entry on the debit or credit side at any time, so people are free to do this in the ledger of life. People are always free in this action, not in spite of the law of karma, but exactly by taking it into account. If we know that everything we do, acting in full freedom, will have an effect in this ledger of life, we cannot agree with someone who will not help someone in need. That is just as if a merchant were about to go bankrupt and asked us to lend him 20,000 marks. Surely you would lend him the money if you knew that he was a good businessman and would use the loan to get into a sound position again. And that is also how it is with those in need. You help them to mend their karma so that their destiny may take a turn for the good. And you are at the same time improving your own karma, having done a good deed. The law of karma is indeed a law for active intervention in daily life. It is particularly important to gain the right understanding of the law of karma exactly from this point of view, when we look at the way it relates to Christianity. Serious misunderstandings exist today among theologians. Modern theologians are saying, quote, we are teaching that with the death on the cross all sins are forgiven. You teach the law of karma, and that contradicts our teaching. Close quote. The contradiction is only apparent, however, for the law of karma has not been understood. Conversely, there are theosophists who say that they cannot accept that the death on the cross means forgiveness of sins. They do, in fact, also fail to understand the law of karma. Let us assume you help someone and intervene in his destiny so that it will be positive. Now, if you were able to help two people, this would also in no way go against the law of karma. Next, assume that you are an individual who is called upon to rid the world of an evil by doing a particular thing. Does that go against the law of karma? The Christ Spirit has done exactly the same thing, on a large scale, as a human being who helped not only hundreds or thousands of people, but the whole of humanity in performing his deed. The death for redemption, of atonement for others, was therefore wholly in accord with the law of karma, and can in fact only be understood in connection with this law. Only those who do not understand will think there is contradiction. It is just as little in contradiction to the law of karma as is the help which I give to a single individual in need. With regard to the law of karma, you have to think of the future, for we make an entry in our account's ledger with everything we do, and this will bear fruit. Contradiction between Christianity and karma could only be seen by those who are still caught up in the childhood diseases of theosophy. Insight into this law of karma will explain many things. In the first place, we can exactly demonstrate the connection between bodily development at this time and our previous lives. A life full of love prepares for a development in the next life that will keep the person young for a long time. Premature aging, on the other hand, is due to much antipathy in the previous life. Secondly, a particularly selfish desire for gain creates dispositions for infectious diseases in the next life. Thirdly, it is particularly interesting that the consequence of pain, and above all certain diseases one goes through, will mean a handsome body in the next life. Such an insight makes it easier for us to bear with some diseases. In reference to and with insight into such destiny connections, one of the greatest Bible scholars, Fabre d'Olivet, used a beautiful image to show how things are interrelated in life. He wrote, quote, "Consider the pearl in the shell. The creature had to suffer, and this suffering has given rise to the beautiful pearl." Close quote. And that is indeed how illness in this life is often connected with something that will add something positive to the next life. Tomorrow, then, about how this may be developed further in a number of different directions. The end of Lecture 7.